Okay, I think we are live. The monitor here shows me that we are live, and this is the Cybersecurity Insider, your host, Igal Behar. Tonight we have two distinguished guests, and I'll present them to you. The first one on the stage will be Steve Maniani. Clap your hands. Steve, how are you today?
Very well, Yigal. How are you doing?
Thank God, as we say. And I'm going to present the second guest, which is Seth Melendez. Melendez, yes. Clap your hands, Okay. We don't see you yet, but going to see you soon. Okay, guys.
You see me?
Yeah, we see you. We see everybody. Yeah, we're clapping hands in delay, of course, which are live. It's always like that. So today we're going to talk about unscripted cybersecurity conversation. So it means that everybody can bring anything that they want to talk about. And before we get started, by the way, we got on Podbean, we got about 1,000 downloads already from various podcasts. So thank you for those people who download our podcast and listen, and they think there is something great in this content. Please continue to do so. And of course, don't forget to like, subscribe, and ask any questions using this email, podcast@thecybersecurityinsider.com. podcast@thecybersecurityinsider.com. Okay. So we're going to get started. Who wants to start? Steve, you want to start? Topic.
Sure. What would you like me to start with?
Whatever you want, Lee.
Whatever I want. Well, yeah, since this is about cybersecurity.
Yes, Steve, not politics, as you like to talk about.
Yes. So let's talk about the gorilla and the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is AI.
Okay.
Hey, I thought you were going to insult me. You said 800-pound gorilla. Are you talking about me?
We're all gorillas here.
I'm just not hairy. That's all different.
Oh, I can give you some if you want.
Sorry, go ahead, Steve.
So I think what we were talking about Yigal, is the fact that AI seems to be perched to be able to come in and do a great deal of many things. And a lot of programs today require, you know, diligent knowledge and understanding to configure, to make the right settings and so forth and so on. And I just see that AI being able to come in and sort of take over a lot of manual related tasks as it relates to managing a network. You know, we talked about, you know, how does a CrowdStrike take that into consideration? Now, you said that a lot of these companies are already using a little bit of AI embedded in their products from when they came out, and probably have increase the use of AI to some extent. And I would think, yes, they have to, because if they don't, they're basically going to face extinction. If, you know, a small company of 250 people doesn't want to pay the subscription to CrowdStrike and would rather pay a much smaller fee to an AI product that's going to basically make sure that, you know, their hybrid cloud configurations are maintained, up to date, and so forth and so on. So a lot more to come on that because it's still in development. But and like we talked about, you know, it's all about the prompts. You get out of it what you put into it, and people are going to learn the AI sources that actually teach you how to provide the correct prompts, unless you're an IT pro and you know what to ask.
Right.
I got a response. You want to come in? Yeah, I have a response. I think a lot of this is overblown. I think we've gone through these new wonder stuff coming down the pipeline. It slowly starts to get here. The wave gets here. Everybody blows it out. Web was like that. You know, everybody's going to lose their job because of web. Everybody's going to lose their job because, you know, they had all these other, you know, the big blue IBM computers. I think they're overblowing a lot of this. I think everything, you know, the technology will find its level, and there are going to be people that are going to get sucked by software people. They're going to sell them all these features they don't use. Think about it. They only use 20% of Microsoft. So if Microsoft adds new features, are they going to use it? You know, the same thing with Google. How much software does Google give you for free as it is? If they add 20 new features that are AI driven, are most people going to use them? You know, other than like, you know, spell checker and a few other software that is AI driven, most people won't even realize what is AI driven and what isn't. And the bosses are not knowing. You see, you've ran against boss. You've talked to these, some of these bosses where they're like, I don't want to change this or I don't want to change that. And they're running on 10-year-old computers. And now all of a sudden they're going to put AI on that 10-year-old computer? So I think that's where the problem is. I think it's overblown. And I think a lot of people are just going to jump in and get soaked and destroyed where other people are doing this tactically and a little smarter. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. I want to interrupt your comments. Steve, you want to answer him or you're good with that?
No, I get that. You know, I'm just thinking that instead of looking for all of those 80% of the features that they're not using, I think AI is just going to bring it right to them.
Yeah. But remember, it's been around for a while. We've been using it in spell checkers and other stuff for ages now. Most people didn't realize it. We've been using it slowly but surely. Just now, the explosion of AI because of ChatGPT. Now everything is AI. But we've been doing it for a while. It just didn't make the AOL version of it, which is ChatGPT. Because think about it. We had email before AOL. AOL just made it more accessible. You have mail. You didn't have to configure stuff. You didn't have to know what your SMTP out was. You didn't have to know all these little configuration things. That's what ChatGPT did for AI. It just made it more accessible to the average person.
I disagree with you. I can't say a lot. Disagree with you. Okay. The examples that you provided now, they're not exactly holding water because you're talking about spell check. Spell check was, yeah, for a while, but it was not AI. Absolutely not. AI really was introduced to Microsoft products. If you subscribe to Microsoft 365 and you get the cloud version, most likely you had already the AI in the past 6 months, probably.
And right, but they had AI in the background doing a lot of their virus checks for about 2 years.
No.
For defense.
No. You didn't have that, no. Really not.
Defender, is it AI driven?
These days, yes, but not 6 months ago or maybe a little bit longer. I can tell you because I know it behind what's going on. And if you pay attention to the programs and updates that Microsoft has introduced, suddenly you started to see that there is AI footprint on those applications. If you're using Office application as a desktop application. You started to see there's suddenly those strange signs of new software being introduced to the Office applications, and those show that they are using AI actually. So it took a while until you saw this, and AI actually with Microsoft was introduced only in the past few months. We're talking about SentinelOne, for instance. We had a conversation with them, and they showed us that they are now trying to bring more AI. What you are missing here is the differences between AI and ML, ML machine learning. So you had machine learning before AI, okay? So spam filtering, for instance, was using different engines that were actually machine learning. So they learned certain patterns, right? And then based on this learning, they were able to increase the detection in spam, for instance. ChatGPT made it, as you said, open to the public in some sort of way, but it's open let's say, open it, for the public use, right? Without using another software in order to use the AI features. And you don't need the PC, actually, an old PC to use AI. You just go to the cloud. Like ChatGPT, you open the browser and right there, you're there, and then you can use it. No big deal.
Well, I'm talking business applications. There are tons of new business
applications. Business application. You don't need that. That's the thing. No. Absolutely not. I disagree with you. You don't need install applications on a computer in order to use AI.
Oh, no, I didn't say definitively. What I'm saying is there are a ton of applications that are out there now that have AI integration in them that are locally based. If you look at there's software that's financial software, there's database, there's different databases that are having them. So what I'm saying is that there are people who want certain softwares out there. They don't want to get the cloud one, but then now they want to move to a local version, but they don't have the equipment yet. So they're going to have a bad experience.
Exactly the opposite. You had all the cloud, all the AI implementations were cloud-based. Now there is a push to move the AI to the local networks and to local computers.
Right, and then they're going to have a bad experience when they do, because their hardware is not up to date.
Oh, absolutely. This is a different topic. They don't know what to do. So here's the thing. A lot of companies, they don't know what to do. I'm talking to people about AI. They are like clueless. They don't understand what's going on. They have no idea what to do. I can tell you that IT companies don't use AI as much as I wanted them to think that. I wanted to think that they are probably use it, and hopefully you, an exception to this rule, is actually using AI, but I don't know. Are you using AI?
I use it with my writing software.
I use it
pretty much weekly, a couple of times a week.
Okay, I can tell you that I use it on a daily basis, every day. Every day, a few times in a day.
Yeah, but it depends on what we're using it for. Because like I said, the software that I'm using is just something for the personal. I know we're using it in the background for the different checks that we're doing for viruses and malware. I know that there's a ton of softwares out there that have it integrated. All of Microsoft and all of Google are now integrated with it. So,
yes, Google also did some integration over there. And now NVIDIA presented the new chip that is going to, that's called the Blackwell, I think. And this is supposed to be amazing GPU that was not before and can do much more than the other one did before. So definitely.
Right, but when you're saying that we're using it every day, you're specifically using it within a specific software. You know what I mean?
Using it on the cloud.
Right, but you're using it, let's say, for doing your network checks or your software checks.
No, not at all. I'm using it especially for marketing purposes.
Right, there's software for marketing.
I use it, so it's that. I'm not using a special software for that. I'm using ChatGPT directly.
Oh, well, what I'm talking about, some of the third-party software companies that have integrated AI. So in general, what I'm saying, if there's a ton of software out there that people are going to buy, like you're saying, it's overblown in the sense, what I was saying, a lot of this is overblown, where you can go out and do some of the things you're already doing, but people are selling you features that you most likely won't use. And then what we're seeing is people making businesses making these decisions to do things in-house when they could have kept it on the cloud, it would have been easier. They don't have the right equipment. So that's why I'm saying a lot of this is overblown and a lot of people are going to get themselves in trouble.
Well, there is probably maybe two reasons. Main reason why people want to use it internally on their systems is because of privacy and propriety. They don't want that information to go, and this is goes to the conversation from between me and Steve earlier. When you use this, those tools and you start to use it on the cloud, there is a chance that this information will leak outside to somebody else. And when you use it internally, meaning you run those LLMs internally, you won't get it. Your information won't be leaked outside. That's really the main reason. And other reasons that I'm not going to say. But
would you consider using Copilot on a daily basis using AI?
Of course, why not?
Right. I mean, I tell people I don't Google anymore.
You don't need to. You go to the you go to the prompt and you ask a question.
Exactly.
Well, ChatGPT is limited to 2022. I know Gemini, the Google one, is more up to date. And I actually like Gemini. I'm actually getting more used to Gemini. I like those people.
Go ahead.
What is Gemini? Is that the Google?
It's Bard. It's Bard. It's the renamed Bard.
It's Google version. It's a ChatGPT for Google.
Right. It used to be Bard. Then they renamed it Gemini.
Yes.
Okay. Because I know Google had a problem and they had to pull it.
Right. And now it's Gemini. So if you, I think if, I have it right here. I think I listed it still under Bard. So if you actually go to the Bard site, actually it's gemini.google.com.
Yeah, but if you're gonna search Bard, if you're gonna search Bard, it's gonna take you to that list anyway.
Right. So it's gemini.google.com, and it's. I actually like it. I'm getting used to it. Like I said, there are other things like we were just saying, Copilot within Word and then within your email, you're gonna be able to type up certain things before you even finish the email. It's gonna give you a bunch of suggestions. Grammarly has been doing AI for about a year now. If not longer, you know, so.
Yes, yeah, Grammarly, yes. They did something, they did yes.
So they've been prepping, so their stuff is accurate, but a lot of that is great in a sense it's gonna help you with certain things, but I think a lot of the marketing is gonna be overblown and it's oversold. I think that's where the problem's coming.
Yes. Marketing is always like with APT, Active Persistent Threat, that was pushed by who was pushing that? FireEye? Which company pushed the APT? One of the companies. They were trying to sell APT, and this is the flagship, and they said they talked about APT and APT while it's always marketing purposes. Okay.
Well, anyway, I think the whole idea of just in talking about it was just to see, you know, what is everyone's perception of its impact on technology in general. I you know, today Microsoft just released the first AI Surface laptops. Exactly what that means, other than making Copilot operate much more effectively and efficiently, I'm not sure, but It's coming. Whatever it is.
One of my biggest concerns is, like he was saying before, privacy. How much more data they're going to collect? Bad enough they've collected so much data from us before. How much more are they going to collect with this AI?
Yeah, and not only collection, they're going to select what the what they're going to collect anyway.
You mean like your driving habits?
Everything. Well, everything is recorded.
Well, if you remember a few years back, I don't know if you guys remember this. It's a story of a young girl who got a call from her mother saying, "Why didn't you tell me you were pregnant?" And she says, "Mom, I only found out yesterday. How did you know?" And it turns out that the mother, since the day that the girl went in for the test and got the results, and her husband been talking about it for like 2 days or a day and a half, and so they were talking about it. All of a sudden, the mother started getting notices from Amazon saying, "Hey, for your grandkid, things for your grandkids, So, hey, so somehow Amazon knew about it way before the daughter told the mother, and so it was so quick. And so then the daughter was like, "How did you know?" Turns out that the lab was selling information from people without people knowing it.
Yeah,
and well, they were still able, even though they didn't have the names, the software was able still to connect this girl with her pregnancy and all the, so it was AI then. And this is what, almost 8 years ago? So they had a way to connect all that together to say, that's her, that's the one that's pregnant now. Oh, yeah. So let's tell her family and others that they need to buy baby gifts.
I think it's not so much AI. Maybe it's machine learning, and maybe there is a those modules that they do data correlation,
right?
And then they get to this point. So if you're talking about 8 years ago, this is probably was the case.
And so it's probably, but what my thing is, it's probably going to be easy to do stuff like that.
Easier, yes.
Right, it's going to be able to do it in whatever time it did it before. It's going to be able to do it in half the time, if not a you know, tenth of the time. And you know, so privacy is pretty much going to go out of the window in general, because it's going to be able to correlate different things. If you start searching for cars, you talk about cars, it's picking up your audio about cars. Now it's going to present you a whole bunch of stuff on cars.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Well, why can't you use AI also as a defensive mechanism?
As a what?
As a defense.
Some companies will have to do that, yeah. But nobody's been able to defend against Google hearing, I mean, Amazon hearing your phone, listening in conversations. Right. No one defended that yet.
Right. So if I go upstairs and I tell Alexa, "Listen, I don't want you giving this information to anyone," and that's a setting that I have a right to demand, and they have the ability to do that through AI, then why not?
Right.
I don't trust it. Even if you're going to tell it not to listen, I don't trust it. this is one of the reasons I don't have Alexa.
They don't have our express permission to listen to our conversations, but they do.
Yes.
Well, no.
I'm not trusting those tools, and I don't have those apps, and I don't have Alexa, and I don't have all those things. I don't think it's really...
I like the Google Nest because it has the button. You can literally switch off the audio. Like, it can't hear anything. So that's what I like about that one. You like, there's a button that turns off, and nothing you could do, they can hear anything. So that part I like.
Maybe. Maybe you press the button, but really, it shows the LED turn from green to red. And say, "Oh, okay, I'll turn it off." But it's not.
It's a false positive.
Right.
Okay. Seth, you want to suggest another topic?
What do you guys think about? I've been noticing, especially with a lot of the updates I've been watching and things like that, we keep running through these cycles of malware hits and, you know, these big, you know, institutional hits, and it always seems like we're not learning anything. It's still bad passwords, no patching. Is the industry just like stagnant when it comes to training, or they just don't care. Because it's like this, I know that they had a, when Linux, when they had that big drive to bring in everybody in, they started bringing these low-level techs upwards into networking, and we had issues with that. And now it just seems like we're still having issues because you still see the same problems over and over and over again. It's not like the hackers, every so often they come up with an ingenious way to infect you and to do things, but they're still doing the same old stuff. They're finding, you know, patches that, you know, methods that were not patched 3 years ago, and they're still infecting people. Or they're, you know, people aren't doing what they're supposed to do, and you have this carelessness with the IT. So that, I'm just wondering, do you guys see a change? Think that I just see it as it's just getting worse.
I think it's a combination of things. First of all, money. If it's a big organization, it's a tolerance for change. Because if you got a patch, maybe, you know, they got to change something because it's going to impact the BAU process. And then it's your IT operations, you know, especially if it's a big organization. The way they categorize the risk and the way they sort of align their SLAs to applying patches. Small organization can get away with it because they're not going to have too many problems. Big organizations, they have to live with the risk. That's the problem. The bad guys know that they have it on board, and they're just going to look for it and eventually, you know, penetrate it.
Yeah, I've noticed, like, I'm not going to say who or anything because it's somebody I know, that their company has had multiple issues over the last couple of years, yet they've never changed their tactics.
Why?
They keep, you know, they just had an outage. Their network went out. Everything is not, it's not even cloud-based. They have an internal network, and so they're averse to technology. So they moved everything in network-wise into their own data center, and they don't want to do anything cloud. But yet, every time they go down, it's in the network. It's always the network or it's something else. It's gone down for different reasons. And it's like, are we in like 2012? It's like these problems could be solved much more easier if you had, let's say, a cloud backup, offsite stuff, or anything like that that they could be using to help them mitigate some of these issues. But they're not doing any of those things. And they're not following. Every time I speak to people over there, or speak to people that knows people over there, they're not following standard protocols that we talk about when they're talking about, you know, their patch schedules, what they're doing.
What do you think the reason? What really did they try to dig in to understand?
I just think it's a mindset because a lot of the administration is older, over 60.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're probably adverse to spending some money and engaging in some change.
I think it's again a combination. Most likely, it's not education. They don't have the sufficient education. They don't want to spend the money. But hear this. When they hit by an attack, a cyber attack, they're going to tell you, and we had this now, the guy, the owner says, you have an open check. Do whatever is necessary to get done. We're sitting with them, with the company and all the employees, and said, okay, the IT guy that we had used, don't call him anymore. That's it. I spoke to that to another guy that they experienced identity theft. He said, no, I'm talking to the MSP company, to the IT company. I don't trust them that much anymore. So those also can be reasons why they don't do anything, because they see that the IT company, the IT guy, you know, whatever who he is, they don't do their job. They don't understand security. I'll tell you a story with that specific client. He created account, email accounts, and he gave everybody admin role on the Office 365. In addition, he made all the users on the computer admin also. So you got to ask me why. As I'm going to tell you, probably didn't want to hear any calls from them. So they can service themselves and they would without calling him. I guess.
And where, let me ask you a question. You've probably dealt with it. I know you're a little bit more lenient, your guy, than others, than I would ever be. Because there's been many clients that I'm like, look, I have to cut you off. You know, in a sense that when you tell them they need to do things, like you said, this guy with the handing out passwords, I couldn't work with them. Because anything you do is going to be messed up and they're going to blame you.
Which one? What are you talking about? Which case with the password?
Right, the guy you just mentioned that they gave out the admin password and made all the users.
No. He didn't give the admin password. No, he made all the accounts, email accounts that he created. He gave them admin role.
Right. So then if you went in there and worked on something and it blew up, they're going to blame you. I wouldn't even take a job for that.
I took the admin role from them. What do you mean?
You did?
I didn't ask.
You don't have like a, you don't say, look, I can't do this while this type of shenanigans. I don't know. No, like give them advice?
No, this is part of the remediation process. You go, you see what's going on, you start fixing it. You don't ask any questions. You just remove them. Oh, the employees were using, besides the Office 365, they had also Gmail account that they use also for the business. We said, no more Gmail. The employees got upset. I'm sorry, you can't use Gmail anymore. You want me to block Gmail from you? No problem. Don't use Gmail anymore. That's it. Done. Of course, we're very hard on them. We didn't give them anything. Now you tell me that I'm more lenient. No, we are not. I'm not lenient. No, not at all.
That sounds like they even let them print on their own printer devices from home.
It's crazy.
That's dangerous.
Yeah, but
and I didn't mean it in a negative. I meant that you're more diplomatic about it than I would be. I didn't mean it. I'm like, you're more diplomatic about it than I would. I'd be like, no, I can't do it.
What do you mean? Can't do it? You don't want to serve them? That's what you would say.
In a sense, there's got to be. Where's the limit? What I'm trying to say. Do you guys have a limit where you say, nah, it's hands off?
It depends. Your
reputation, anything.
It depends. Here's the thing. So let's say we work with a customer, and the customer says, I don't want to do it. Whatever it is. Now, it depends what it is. And sometimes you need to be lenient because there's a certain circumstances. For instance, let's say they have this customer, they have a website with different applications. They upload files from here, up there. They're doing a lot of things over there. And you can't be strict with them. But at least they are going to that direction, meaning they are making the changes. It's going to take longer. So what I'm suggesting is to add the compensating controls. So I'm going to feel comfortable with it. So for instance, let's say I can't make a DMZ because they have issues. I'm going to put a WAF between the web browsers, whatever, before the web server. This way I know that I'm protecting them. This is what you need to do. You need to think out of the box. Okay, you can't do this way. Okay, maybe I can find a different way how to allow them to function without reducing security. But actually, you're adding security, and it's better than the status now is a little bit better than it was before.
Yeah, so that's what I get involved with, Seth, with security assessments on third parties. You know, I used to be on the security side doing the assessment itself.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm on the other side. I'm on the risk side. So I get the assessments and the findings as a result of the assessments. Now I have to figure out how can I reduce the number of findings as best as I can so we're not overloading, you know, the GRC system with millions of findings. that have to be tended every year or every 3 years. So we look for compensating controls, mitigating factors to drive down the risk. If the BZO says it gets to a low, we call it a low and it gets automatically accepted. That's like being closed. Doesn't mean the risk doesn't exist.
Right.
So you need to be flexible. Sometimes they don't have the budget. Sometimes they have, they need to do some programming. They need to change the system, the processes. It's also business processes that they need to change. You can come and think because whatever you're telling them, and not to say that whatever you're telling them, it's not important. It is very important. However, you can come and enforce on them to do something that they can't do because they have certain processes in place, business processes, and they can't change it overnight. And you come to say, okay, guys, do you have a documentation of all the systems that you have and the processes that are associated with it? No, we don't have it. So if you're going to go and do whatever I recommend them to do.
Right, and I'm not saying in one visit. I'm just looking for the threshold where you would walk away.
Look, those guys that I work with them, I work with them already years. I'm not going to walk away from them.
Okay.
You need also as a service person to have some compassion for the customer because they're in it, they need you. So you need to be have a compassion and say, okay, I understand your point of view. Let's find a way how to help them. Okay, you can't do this. Where can you do this? Or maybe you can do it. Maybe we can do something else. Come suggest something else.
I'll give you a quick for instance.
Okay, excellent.
A client that I had years ago, we kept working with them on different projects. Okay. And then we'd go through, you know, the user training and everything else like that. And then we go through all the follow-up calls as people got used to it and things like that. They would go in and change everything out of the blue. Like if let's say they were having issues because people weren't understanding the training, instead of saying, hey, we need to train them a little better, they would just give them admin or they would do things that would screw everything up you're doing. And it would happen multiple times on projects. And it's like, it's a point where you're going to wind up getting blamed for something or you're going to be put at fault for something if they have a disaster or a major issue. Especially when they're not following the documentation or the rules, you know, the group, what we've decided to do in this plan, they're just going outside of it every time there's a hiccup or every time there's some, you know, little bit of a problem that they need. They don't want to deal with it. They just, it's easier to give, to do the least amount and introduces more problems later.
Okay.
And then when I build for extra, you go in, fix problems, do this, and then you find more problems. Then they were getting upset because, oh, but you're billing more. You said it wouldn't be that. No. If you would have kept it this way, we'd be okay. But you kept changing it, so you keep introducing more problems.
Okay, and then you ended up firing the client.
After a certain point, yeah, I had to. Because it just was, I was just eating up more time dealing with them, and then they were doing more bitching because now I'm sitting there billing them, this, you know, and they're like, well, but isn't that part of what we did over here in that project? That's our scope. So that's where the problem, that's what I'm saying. And that's what I think of when I deal with things like that. It's like, there's a point where it's like, I can't ruin my reputation because of this.
So one way what you could do is give them a document and say, in this document, I'm removing any responsibility for all these projects because you keep changing and sign off this document that you recognize the responsibility and you're going to acquire this responsibility from me and you as a business owner, I don't know with whom you talk, or maybe the manager said, okay, sign this document. I'm not responsible anymore for what's going on because you are not following what we have agreed before. I had the same issue with a similar scenario. And the client said, oh, listen, you invoice us for email security and endpoint protection and all the wise. I think it's too much. Right? It sounds familiar, right? So I explained to him. I said, listen, email security is to protect from email threat coming through the email. You have endpoint protection is to protect. This is another layer of security, which handle different threats, but both of them giving you better security than you had before. And I disagree with you. You need it. It's absolutely needed. That's it. I stood my ground, but I did it nicely, but I was very, very firm about it. And I said, I'm not going back out. Actually, I wanted to fire him because of a different reason, not because of those reasons.
Right. Steve, you have a limit? Or are you diplomatic like Lee Gao?
So, you know, so mine is a little different because mine is all about assessing specific findings. So if somebody, if a vendor is going to tell me, well, you know, we've got this and here's the evidence of how we do it, and that should take care of it. So if they're supposed to have cryptographic key management, let's say, right? And they're giving me something about they're using BitLocker, right? Well, I'll say, well, BitLocker will give you encryption, but it's not a cryptographic key management solution. It's not storing keys. It's not managing keys. It's not doing any of that. So on the purity of what is cryptographic key management, it doesn't work. We'll say, no, sorry. You got to go to the business. The business has to say, we'll accept the risk. And if it's a high risk, CISO in the organization has to also accept that the business is going to accept that risk. So there are layers there to ensure. But I see from your guys' perspective, when you're dealing with retail customers, my limit would be, you know, anything that can come back to hurt me, it's going to be a line. And I'm going to tell the client, you sign right here. Because if anything happens, you sign that. You said it was okay to do it this way. Because I'm telling you it's not.
Because I worked internally to a pharmaceutical company, and we were working on projects, and they just kept telling us, well, just go ahead and you could turn off the firewall and do it that way while you guys are working. We're like, what? Turn off the firewall? Are you crazy? Well, you guys are having so many problems getting through the firewall and it dropping. Just turn it off while you, oh, and I kept, I'm like, there's no way I'm turning that firewall off. And it's, you know, I'll be in cuffs tomorrow. You know, there's no way I'm not doing it. And so it was one of those things I was like, and that was working internal. It's like, there's no way I'm doing it. There's no way. Not in a million years I'm doing it.
Do you know that when I was at Citigroup for a long time, I'd say half of my time there was on information security. I got into a couple of conversations about our development environment. I says, is this internet facing?
Yes.
Yeah. He said, really?
Yeah, it's live.
All these rules about production, but not one of them is ever mentioned in the context of the development environment, right? Because it would have cost the company millions to build a development environment. We needed actually two development environments, right? One that wasn't facing the internet and one that was.
Right.
In other words, we need to build a proxy in front of the development website. And I said, man, there's a shitload of vulnerability and risk that everyone is just assuming doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that's the case everywhere, right? Because most development environments, you know, if you're an application shop, you gotta test it on the internet, it's facing the internet.
One of the things that we see with development software company, they develop on the production. They don't have a separate environment to do. So you have a production, but you don't have a development and testing environments. which are different.
Yeah.
So let's say the production environment is more is hardened and is for public use. Where you have the testing, it's similar to the production in terms of the setup, but then you can test and see that the application works like really. And then you have the dev environment, which is you can do whatever you want to do on the dev environment, but they don't have it. So it's a real problem there.
Yeah, but I with a lot of when virtualization came along, I thought a lot of that type of hesitation disappeared because you could create 1,000 dev environments now virtually and do your testing.
Yes.
You know, yes. And I thought, you know, I would have assumed that that type of problem would have went away a long time ago with virtualization.
No, it's still there.
I don't believe Citi ever used the virtualization for their dev environment.
Yeah, because when I was working with Johnson & Johnson, that's all they did is just run up dev environments in virtualization. Like they were one of the biggest virtualized companies way before everybody else did. And this goes back to 2006. They were doing virtualization with ESX and VMware and that stuff, VMware. And we were just constantly, and we actually had to create just siloed environments for them not only to test. We'd actually duplicated certain production and brought it into the dev environment just so they have the database, the front end website, you know, the web app, and all the different components that they could test whatever part they wanted. And, you know, they didn't need to call 40 people up, you know, to get a blessing. And like you said, and to reduce some of the hardening so that they could test without a problem. And then we can work through the hardening with them later on, you know, as they try to, you know, to roll it out. But at least they could test and fix certain things within, you know, within their different pieces and their different silos. But we literally created the whole production environment in dev so that they could do that. And then they could spin up drop machines as they wished.
Did they use actual production data that was not redacted in the development environment?
As far as I know, yes. Yep. This is early on. This is early on. So I don't think a lot of those, 2006 around there. So it was early on in that whole world that we just started virtualizing what was there. And because that was physical machines. And so we would virtualize them because then they was also going through a consolidation here, a part two, because then they were identifying machines that were going to get virtualized and put into the virtual production. So that was twofold and threefold things going on with virtualization at the time. So that's what we started doing. And no one ever said anything about the virtual data, the production data being brought into virtual.
My God.
So then that goes way back. And there are other companies like that that have done virtual, they'll make their own virtual dev environment. Some didn't care about the production data, some did over time. As we went through all that type of risk analysis, like you said, I guess some of them realized, hey, we have to use dummy data.
Okay. I think we are top 46 minutes.
That was painless.
Painless.
This is a joke.
Okay. Any closure or to close this this podcast?
Building out a new server. I'm trying to test out 2022. I know that they're getting ready to put out the 2023 demo soon, right? The RTM or one of the ones. They're ready to put it out.
Really? Oh, yeah, obviously, yeah, release candidate.
Right. So I think they're getting ready to put out 2024 or 2025, whatever it is.
Yeah, who counts?
So I'm ready to play with that.
I see. Oh, maybe 2025.
2025, I think it is.
Yeah, introducing Windows Server 2025. Okay, so when this is
Should be out soon. I think in the next few months, you're going to get the art.
We did implement the 2022. Now they're just with 2025.
Isn't that what that happens a lot? Like some people skipped over 7, went to 8. You know what I mean? It happens.
They want the money.
Well, you go through the 5-year life cycle, 6-year life cycles quick. You know what I mean? Nobody wants to be in the beginning. So by the time they put it in, you're already 3 years in or 4 years in. Then it's 3 years later, it's already gone.
Okay, here it is. So they have Windows Server, hot patching for everyone, next generation Active Directory and SMB. I don't know what is next generation AD, mission critical data and storage. Look at that, Hyper-V and AI. Okay, so when this is supposed to be? It looks like Windows 11 still. Looks like the way we know it is. Okay, this is the image, the setup. And today, okay, what's today? What day was it? Oh, January 26th.
Yeah, the small business group that we're both part of just did a demo last couple weeks ago.
Oh, really? I was not there. Okay. Here. Get started. Oh, Windows Insider Program. Okay. I guess I need to join that. Okay. All right. Okay. So we got another thing in the end. Okay. I'm going to stop the sharing. Okay. Steve. Any other comments?
I have one little story to tell. We assessed this company that's located in China, and they had 43 findings. And they provided us with action plans and target dates to close all of them except one. They are using end-of-life, unsupported servers and exchange servers. I said, I don't think you're going to be able to roll out all of these action plans on equipment that is end-of-life. Because they had no intention of replacing this equipment. I said, you're going to have to go to your management, talk to them and really get them to understand they need to upgrade that, because probably half of these, remediations won't work, won't take.
So, as I say, good luck and good luck. Good luck and good luck. Okay, maybe that is actually gives the answer for the first question that was introduced, why companies don't do what they need to do. All right. Let's end this.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for coming to this show. And again, questions, comments. Podcast at thecybersecurityinsider.com. And don't forget to share, like, and subscribe. Thank you guys, Steve and Seth, for coming, joining tonight. Have a good night. Enjoy the rest of your night. And we're going to end up with this.